Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jeronimo Cortina, political scientist at the University of Houston.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor here at the University of Houston also. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking politics. And Jeronimo, there is a lot of politics to talk about. This week, big news, a Florida judge has struck down the CDC's requirement that there be masks on public transportation, specifically airlines. What do you make of this decision?
Well, obviously, it's part of the, I guess, politicized issue that happened with the pandemic. Yeah. It's perhaps one of the last straws or one of the last battles in terms of what's going to happen regarding the mask mandates. But the interesting thing here is that, you know, the big question, I think, regardless of whether airlines are allowed or not, or are forced or not to require masks, and generally not only airlines, but public transportation, the big question is, who is the health authority in this country, right?
Yeah.
And who is in charge of basically guarding public health?
So I think don't we do our own research though? Like, just do your own research, right?
Well, that's true.
True. I think it tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. You just need to go on the internet or anything like that, and then boom. No, yeah. I mean, just word of advice. Any medical advice has to go through a doctor. Just you know,
smart.
FYI.
Like, so I don't have, like, you know, eyeball cancer because I'm coughing. Is that the could be allergies? Could be eyeball cancer. Who knows?
Yeah, I suggest that you visit your primary physician and
wise man,
and then just see what they say.
But you're right. So it's an important institutional battle because the Biden administration is in a tough bind, right? Because as an executive in control of the executive branch, they want to make sure that the authority of their agencies is not corrupted and that they can have this ability to legally make this case. But politically speaking, like you said, it's a tough balance because Biden, I think, would like to have this removed. And they last week had a short-term extension of this so that they're kind of taking it, frankly, like week by week, like we all are, just to get it through, right? But they're working on it week by week. And I think that they were inclined to remove it. But the problem is that the science says you should probably still wear it. And so the CDC is basically appealing this on the grounds that they're the health authority and that, frankly, probably it should be done. But I think Biden might like this to be kind of off their plate. Right? You've got a busy summer coming up and people want to travel and people don't like the masks. So at least this is one thing off their desk.
And the other thing is that if because the DOJ has says that, you know, it's planned to appeal, but it hasn't appealed. And, you know, when we have these issues, immediately the Department of Justice appeals like a minute after, right? But the question is that this would go to the 11th Circuit that is, you know, tends to be ideologically on the conservative side. And if it doesn't go there, then it will go to the Supreme Court. And we have seen that, you know, mask mandates or pandemic related mandates, zero. The court's 11. So it doesn't have, you know, a very significant future at the court. So we'll see. And as you say, it's like, you know, yeah, we're going to appeal, but you know what? We're very busy right now. We're just trying to do it. And then 2 months later, he's like, hey, what's up with the appeal? Oh, the appeal, I forgot. We're short staffed. And, you know, that's it, man.
Right. It's like why we can't get, you know, cream cheese, because it's just supply chain problems. Like, it's the bottom of your email list. But you're right. I mean, I think the CDC needs to preserve this authority. And so that, to me, is the biggest question here. The question about the health of this is really for a lot of people kind of up to themselves. And so that's what the basically airlines are saying, is telling people, like, you know, you can choose to do it or you can choose not to do it, even though the CDC recommends it. So this is going to be an interesting question. And let's just say legally, it's going to be a bind because the statutes are clear. The CDC has this authority. But of course, the courts can overturn that pretty quickly. So we'll keep an eye on that. Obviously, people are anxious because there are sizable numbers of people who would like to see this go. But polling actually suggests that people would like it to stay. It's a little you know, kind of split. So only about 50% of people say they want that to stay, but it's certainly a plurality. So this is going to be an ongoing fight. And right. I guess the pandemic's over when we no longer have to do it, but right. It's certainly the case the CDC recommends it. So we'll have to kind of check that. In other interesting news this week coming out of Michigan, a very little known Democratic state senator, multiple people mentioned this to me, named Mallory McMorrow, effectively kind of took on the GOP, who had accused her in a fundraising email of wanting to, quote, groom and sexualize kindergartners and teach, quote, that 8-year-olds are responsible for slavery. So she, in a very impassioned speech, pushed back on this, saying this was completely wrong, that this is not the way that the laws are written, and you're sensationalizing this, which is completely out of question. The speech went viral. It amassed almost 13 million views and counting, and has propelled her in terms of donations. So I bring it up not because we care that much about Michigan, although, you know, go blue. I do care about how this is perceived in terms of the politics of this. So my question to you is, has the GOP gone too far in telling the country that the Democrats who want to, you know, educate kids about, you know, racial injustice and about human sexuality have gone too far?
Well, I think so. And she raised a very significant point, and I think this is you know, the real question. And the real question is that she was arguing that the GOP cannot monopolize the moral and religious high ground for their mm-hmm. identity group, right? Mm-hmm. And also pretending to be above, you know, identity mongering or advancing, you know, a cruel and exclusionary agenda. So I think that is a real question, right? Yeah. Moral values or religious values or whatever are universal, right?
Yeah.
So the way that they are making these and appropriating these and making these a political culture war argument, I think is going beyond. And the position that they're going to take is going to affect their electoral futures. And the reason for that is that, you know, younger voters tend to be more progressive, whether for one party or the other. Either even young Republicans tend to be more progressive on certain issues, right?
Yes.
And these issues are going to, you know, create, to a certain extent, animosity in terms of how these things are playing public opinion.
Yeah. And the Democrats have really struggled with a way to counteract this kind of culture war fight. They have not had the tools. This might be an opportunity. I think the least woke Democrat, James Carville, chimed in and said that this is a good model. Like, this is a way for them to push back on this. Like, we can continue to sort of have this education as needed and be woke in a, you know, non-partisan way, but also make sure that they defend their territory. And so this could be a model. So we'll see if, like, this kind of messaging, like you said, really does hold up, and if we see Democrats across the country, including Texas, use this as a model. But as it is now, it's been pretty interesting to see how it's perpetuated across the country. Well, I hesitate to even bring this up because we've got an election in 2022, but 2024, Geronimo, is right around the corner. I just got a terrible chill up my spine, but it is coming, whether you like it or not. But it's going to look very different, potentially. Two really big things happened this week. The first is that the Republican National Committee voted to require GOP presidential candidates to attest in writing that they will only appear at party-sanctioned primary and general election debates. This is basically an escalation of the disagreement that the Trump campaign had with the Presidential Commission on Debate, and following grievances that there was unfairness and that effectively the moderators were biased. So the RNC is going to have more control over what their candidates do in terms of debates. The second thing is that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, is officially reopening its presidential nomination process. So no more first in the nation primary for New Hampshire, maybe no more first Iowa caucus. It's going to potentially be Nevada, Michigan, maybe Texas, question mark. So they're throwing it open to everybody. This comes after a debacle in 2020 where the Iowa caucuses just completely melted down. I mean, it's like the worst tech failure, you know, since the, you know, Microsoft 2000 Windows came out. Like, it was a disaster. And so the DNC wants to basically say, let's rethink this whole thing. And that's what they're doing. So 2020 is going to look a little different, at least in terms of the structure of it. What do you make of these changes?
Well, obviously, the big changes that the DNC wants to do is to, you know, start with states that look more like the nation in terms of diversity, in terms of geographic, you know, standing, size of the state. I don't know.
you don't have corn growing in your yard like Iowa.
not this year. I change crops because you have to change every so often so the soil maintains its mineral nutrients.
Yep. Maybe you do have something in common with the Iowans, right?
Well, I do actually. Right. So I mean, it's just, you know, looking for states that are more diverse. Right. And that's a key idea. And I think that Iowa is primarily a state that is majority non-Hispanic white, mm-hmm. and it doesn't reflect to a certain extent the overall base of the Democratic Party and that big, I guess, alliance that exists between certain groups. So I think, you know, they're trying to do that. And they're trying to say, you know, not discount candidates in the beginning of the primary season that may be elected by a group of voters are not reflected of, you know, the DNC, you know, big alliance.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and honestly, this gives the party a lot more control over who the nominee is. So you're not going to have like a Barack Obama, who was not a great kind of clear partisan for the Democrats. You're not going to have a Donald Trump, who was not even a Republican until he signed his name saying, you know, I'm going to run as a Republican, de-escalating down that gold-plated escalator. So you're not going to have candidates like that, because the party now can control who gets the nomination since they can decide where to start. So for instance, if you start in Nevada, which is a much more diverse state, a much more union-focused state, this is definitely going to present a different kind of Democrat than like New Hampshire, who's got a lot more independence, right? So that's going to characteristically change the dynamic of who runs and who wins. And so this is really important. And I think that depending on what the DNC does here, it could really reshape the Democratic Party and possibly the Republican Party going forward. But what about Texas? Texas is going to try to throw its hat in the ring, potentially. It's got to get this through the GOP-led legislature, which I'm not sure they would really mind, although an early primary presents other kinds of problems. So do you think that Texas could be in the mix on this? I mean, we look a little bit like Nevada. We're extremely diverse, but it's an expensive state, right? You've got 20 media markets. To run here at a first in the nation or second in the nation primary would be really pretty spendy. So I don't know if that's the right way. And our union rates are really low, 10% or lower. So it's not the kind of traditionally Democratic state. And frankly, the DNC hasn't paid a lot of attention to Texas. We've talked about this before. So are we going to be in the mix on this or what?
Well, I mean, certainly, right? Anyone can throw their hat into the ring. I mean, even Iowa, New Hampshire, you know, Nevada, whoever wants to do it, they can do it. The big question, I think, is, you know, what's going to be the strategic outcome of allowing one state versus the other? As you say, you know, Texas may not be very reflected. The messaging that you could say is that, well, we have this big candidate that won in Texas, and perhaps, you know, that's a signaling to the other states or to the other primaries. However, as you say, it's very, very expensive to run a campaign here in Texas.
Yeah.
So the big question is, you need a lot of people, you need a lot of money, and then perhaps you're going to start excluding some candidates that have not had the leeway to get their ground game. But again, the question is, if you haven't ready for Texas, is should be should you be running for, you know, the big one, right?
That's a great point. Yeah. It should be a proving ground, right? No more Jimmy Carters are going to sneak the nomination away from people, right? You're forgetting the intangibles, like we've got plenty of brisket. We've got, you know, we make our own bourbon now, like lots of good stuff for automotive.
And vodka. People wanna,
and vodka, yeah. You can get anything here. So Texas presents it all. We're like a advertisement for the tourism board or something. But it does mean something. And I think you're right politically. Now, political scientists, if they had their way, would have the primaries all on the same day, because the staggered nature of it creates all kinds of problems. So that's going to be interesting. But what about debates? So RNC says only sanctioned debates. Debates typically aren't that helpful. They happen too late to change people's minds. Scholarship shows that basically people have already, you know, retreated to their own camps by the time the debates come around. So it's obviously not like the most important thing, but it's still a bad marker of Democratic health if we don't have these debates, which the RNC is threatening to do, isn't doing, but is threatening to do. So what do you make of that?
We should have them, right? Yeah. I mean, it's as you say, it's a market of an advanced democracy. Whether people watch it or not, a lot of people watch them. It is extremely important. And even though that, you know, may not sway a lot of minds in terms of vote preferences, I think, you know, people can be better informed, and a functioning democracy needs that people are as informed as they can. So I think it's really important to have it. And I think that the RNC saying, well, we're not going to play, it's a bad signal, right? It's a bad signal for the democratic process.
Yeah, and the scholarship on this shows that debates are mixed in terms of the effect. But the one thing it does show symbolically is that we can have the two major party candidates stand in the same room and talk about issues. That is by itself just symbolically important. And so not having that, I think, does send a bad signal that we just can't resolve our differences. And that's really the kind of cornerstone of democracy. So we'll see how that plays out. Now, the RNC isn't saying that they won't have that happen. They're just having more control over it. But here you go again, parties having more control over that process. So we'll see the obvious implications to whom they nominate. Speaking of potential 2024 candidates, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, is in the news this week, battling once again a familiar foe to everybody, Mickey Mouse. The battle against Walt Disney has escalated because the Governor DeSantis has decided that he is going to ask lawmakers to consider repealing the governing structure for Florida's Disney properties. This move could potentially end some of the special privileges the company has long enjoyed since the late 1960s, and could potentially spike bond debt, which would be passed on to that county to the tune of about $1 billion. So is it worth fighting with Mickey Mouse? I mean, can you even beat Mickey Mouse? He's such a wily character, right? And he's got a whole gaggle of friends who are equally, you know, wily as he. So do you want to take on Mickey Mouse right now?
Not really. And also, I mean, again, this is a political statement, right? And the political statement is that, you know, Disney came out after the Don't Say Gay law that was passed in Florida saying, you know, that this law has to be repealed by the state legislator struck down in courts, right? And that they remain as a company committed and supporting any organizations that would want to do that. But the real issue here is it's about money and how counties are going to be hurt eventually, right?
Yes.
So the Reedy Creek Improvement District that is basically allows Disney to behave as a county. Disney controls and maintains 134 miles of roadways, 65 miles of waterways. They do 60,000 tons of waste management, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I just got a picture of Donald Duck out there, like working the road crew, like, you know, laying tar.
So, I mean, they have, I mean, eventually these services will have to be done by county governments.
Yeah.
And I don't think
that's a huge spike in property tax bills potentially, right?
Oh, absolutely. Everything, right? Everything. And as we said last week, Ron DeSantis won last election with 30,000 votes.
Yeah.
And, you know, these could potentially have a significant, you know, unintended consequence when, you know, a candidate says repealing this thing or this thing has been repealed, your property taxes are going to go up because, you know, counties need to maintain these 134 miles of roadways.
That's a great
point. Where are we going to get the money? So
we talked about the same issue, last week with respect to the border and here in Texas, Greg Abbott, right?
Exactly.
Spending billions of dollars. Well, people complain about their property taxes going up. Well, that money has been allocated, so you could reallocate. It's not clear it's a politically resonant argument, though. I think also the fact is that, like we said last week, you're seeing a real slow motion undoing of the relationship between the Republican Party and big business. They're not afraid to tackle companies like Disney, who are major employers in their state. In Texas, it would be like the, you know, governor going after, you know, HEB or something, right? Just the sort of beloved and high employer. So it's a new world, I think. And part of it, I think, is that the base of the Republican Party has changed. It's become more populist, more anti-business, more of the mindset that they should get government out of the business of picking winners and losers. So as the base changes, the politicians feel like they can be emboldened to take on some of these issues and to,
but,
you know.
But let me ask you a question. Why do you think that companies, because, I mean, it's not only the Republican Party saying bye-bye to these big companies, right?
Yeah.
These big companies are also saying bye-bye.
Yeah, true.
Why do you think that these big companies are saying bye-bye?
Yeah.
They're simply saying bye-bye because the consumer base of those companies, right, has changed.
Yeah.
And the consumer base of those companies that maintain them, they want companies that are going to be inclusive.
Yeah.
They want companies that leave and let leave people. They want companies that allow, you know, that are responsible with the environment, that are responsible and proactive in terms of social issues, right? So it's also companies that say, you know what, my consumer base doesn't want these type of stop, so
yeah.
See you later.
Yeah,
and,
that's a great point.
And we'll see.
Yeah.
So it's also a very calculated movement from these big companies parting ways from these type of policies that are, you know, related to what we just said a couple of minutes ago, right?
Yeah.
This issue about, you know, pushing these issues very, 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 very far.
Yeah, and big business recognizes that they're one of the few institutions left that's really trusted. And so they're right. Trying to do their best to just navigate all these politics, right? It's not the church
right.
Anymore. It's not politicians for sure, if it never really has been. So that's definitely them stepping into that role. And as you say, that can be politically dicey. So we're seeing the effects of that. And I guess we'll check to see if, you know, this actually has any legs, you know, come November, because it's been something that every, you know, state has been dealing with. So we'll track that. But speaking of tracking voting questions, Geronimo, some interesting news this week out of our hometown here in Houston. That is that Steve Hotze, who is a far right wing agitator, has funded the prospect of trying to find voter fraud. He has been indicted on charges of unlawful restraint and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. The story is, as crazy as it sounds, the following. A former police officer was hired by Hotze. This person was indicted on a charge of aggravated assault with a weapon late last year. Effectively, this person was following and then pulled over and unlawfully detained somebody they thought had a box full of illegal ballots. Turns out they were an air conditioner repair person and did not have anything related to election or electioneering. So this person, this former police officer, is certainly in trouble. Steve Hotze now has been indicted. Gary Polland is his attorney, and he has said effectively that he wasn't there and only did the money work for it, so shouldn't be indicted. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's once again this issue of, you know, pushing out conspiracy theories and pushing out these the conspiracy theory that Democrats, you know, had collected hundreds of thousands of fraudulent ballots.
Yeah.
And, you know, gonna insert them into the election outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, part of the argument is that, you know, the report that these ex-police officer, Mr. Aguirre, said that the truck contained 750,000 fraudulent mail ballots that were prepared by Democrats. And again, was not true. And
zero.
It is, you know, end of April 2022. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen any significant evidence, right, that there was any fraudulent activity on behalf of any political party.
Right. Like, if you wrote this as a screenplay, you would be rejected because it's so silly. Like, nobody would believe this
right.
is true, right? But it's
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
It is such a comedy of errors. But, and obviously it's important because there's been this constant churn about the question about voter fraud. And a countless number of studies have shown that it is so rare that you'd rather most likely be hit by lightning. So it's something that obviously
yeah.
is not really happening in big numbers, but you still see this be a big push. In fact, even this last month or 2 months ago, the state's own attorney general weighed in and said at an event with Steve Hotze that he would help him hire private detectives to investigate and identify and expose the criminal fraud here in Harris County. So he's got some institutional backing too. So this is definitely problematic, but I'm glad to see at least some sense of accountability coming to this, that people are aware that this is a real problem and we cannot have this kind of activity because it's just disastrous for the health of democracy, but also it's making a joke of the election process.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think you're 100% right. And, you know, people just need to know the facts. And, you know, there wasn't anything there.
Yeah.
There's no fraud. So stop. Let's move on.
Stop. Move on.
End of story.
Yeah. Right. Well, Donald Trump, as we've seen, is still relitigating this. And so I don't know how far they're going to move on from this, at least most people. But that's to be seen in the next election. Speaking of, we've got runoffs coming up, Geronimo, and some big races on the Democratic side with some big money. One includes Congressional District 28. This is Henry Cuellar, who is a sitting U.S. representative. We've talked about him before. He was had his office and home raided by the FBI. Turns out he's not a target. But the residual of that remains. In campaign finance reports, Jessica Cisneros, who's a kind of more progressive challenger, outraised Cuellar by nearly $1 million. Now, it spent him $1.1 million to $580K. So this is a pretty significant investment in the kind of progressive side of the Democratic Party. Is it going to work?
Well, I mean, she was a top fundraiser, right, in federal elections, surpassing basically Texas darlings in terms of fundraising, right? Yeah. Representative Crenshaw, even Senator Cruz, she raised $2.4 million in this quarter, and she raised more than almost $1.7 million more than Henry Cuellar, right?
Yeah.
And this illustrates once again, right, that the Democratic Party in Texas is going through these growing pains, this transition. And as far as I know, and I'm going to quote a very famous political scientist, Brandon J. Roddinghouse, that said that, you know,
I know that guy.
money, right? Yeah. And here we have, you know, how, you know, people that are supporting her candidacy see that she has a certain future and electability in terms of winning the general election.
Yeah. And outside money is key because a lot of this is definitely not from the district. Another case in which we're seeing this is in Dallas, and that's in Congressional District 30 to replace Eddie Bernice Johnson. State Representative Jasmine Crockett has outraised Jane Hope Hamilton, who's her challenger in this, just by a little bit, and outspent her just by a little bit. But the big news is that you have $2 million of independent expenditures from the super PAC outside trying to make that change. So this is definitely again, shows you those growing pains you're talking about. You've got a split in the Democratic Party in North Texas. They're worried that, you know, this coronation could be a problem. So we're seeing some of the evidence of that come about. The last thing we want to talk about is about the politics of abortion. And although it hasn't been kind of front and center in a way that it is for many elections, this week some interesting news came about. And that is that Briscoe Cain, who's a state representative from the Houston area, warned Citigroup, the business, in a letter saying that effectively that he was going to introduce a bill to prevent the bank from underwriting new municipal bonds in the state unless the Citigroup rescinded its policy covering travel expenses for employees who wanted to leave Texas to get an abortion. Hard to get an abortion in Texas. There's been lots of evidence of this, and Citigroup has offered to pay for their employees to leave the state to get one. But Wendy Davis has also entered the chat suing Chairman Cain, basically saying that these laws are unconstitutional. What do you make of the fight about abortion in Texas and in the nation? Is it going to be the rallying point for both sides in 2022?
I think it's going to be, right? I think it's going to be very important. And once again, we have businesses, right, entering, big businesses.
Yeah.
I mean, Citi, this is not, you know, a small business, right?
Yes.
This is Citi being controlled. So, you know, and you see these disjunctive arguments in terms of, you know, weren't you allowed, or weren't you the one that said that businesses should do whatever they want, but now they cannot do it because now they're, you know, against you in terms of these ideological propositions?
Right.
So it's that part that is interesting. And again, I see that, you know, these big businesses are going to start pulling far away from these individuals, right?
Yeah.
And from the Republican Party. And again, that's bad because what we need in this country country is party competition. Mm. We need to have competitive elections, whether it's Democrats against Republicans or Republicans against Democrats. We need this level of high competition so elected officials are accountable.
Yeah. And for Davis's purposes, the Supreme Court's already rejected some of the arguments, but they have to keep pushing because this is really the cornerstone of Roe v. Wade. And if Roe v. Wade is to be overturned, then they want to have it before the election because then it's a rallying point to be able to use politically. So we'll see how this tracks. Of course, we know court cases take forever. So politically speaking, you know, things are going to happen between now and then. But we're going to keep an eye on this and everything in Texas and national politics. And hopefully you're with us on this. So if you're interested, you know, give us a like on Facebook, in Spotify, or in wherever you're getting your podcasts from. Make sure to send us an email at partypoliticspod@houstonpublicmedia.org.
Absolutely. We love to hear from you either through email, but also you can let us know what you think through our Twitter account at HPM Politics.
Hey, big thanks to our producer, Troy Schultz, and everybody at Houston Public Media for making us sound so good.
I'm Jeronimo Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. The party keeps up next week.